Thanks very much for the invitation to speak with you today. I'm going to talk about a few of the figures whom you've already heard about, but I'll hopefully do so with a twist that keeps them interesting. And I apologize in advance if I break out in a coughing fit. I've had a rather bad cold the last couple of days, so please bear with me if I do. Consider for a moment the Curiosity Carnival, an event that took place here in Oxford just last month. According to its official website, the carnival provides a chance to find out what research is really all about, meet researchers, ask questions, and discover how research affects and changes all our lives. Research, it continues, is feeding curiosity and answering questions. Being all about research, the carnival describes itself as one huge festival of curiosity. The neo-syllogism here seems clear. If curiosity drives research, and research affects and changes all our lives, then who wouldn't want to be curious? In its title and in its founding assumptions, the Curiosity Carnival, I take it, is representative of modernity's attitude toward curiosity more generally. Curiosity is a good thing, and it should be maximally exercised. There are, of course, moments when particular ways of feeding or satisfying curiosity might make one feel a bit queasy. Take, for example, a recent article in The Guardian describing the tourist industry in China that indulges Chinese interest in North Korea. Tourists can get on a boat in northern China and travel upriver to a point where they are surrounded by North Korean land on both sides. They do this, according to a tourist guide from one of these boats, because they want to, quote, satisfy their curiosity about North Korea. In particular, he says, they want to see how poor North Koreans are. Most, says the article's author, come simply to gawk. The baseline assumption that most 21st century persons carry around with them is that avid curiosity, the desire to know, is laudable and should be encouraged whenever and wherever possible. Intensely curious we are, and absent a stunning evolutionary reversal of some sort, curious we shall remain. Given our love of curiosity, it's regrettable that on occasion we fail to exercise it in an admirable manner. But in the face of the benefits flowing from curiosity's exercise, that is a risk we generally must live with. That we are keenly curious, and that we therefore ought to be keenly curious, might seem obvious today, but historically many of our predecessors were reluctant to encourage curiosity as unconditionally and as energetically as we do now. People have thought and written about the phenomenon of curiosity for a very long time, as we've already seen, reflecting the centrality of the desire to know how we human beings have understood ourselves. Although the desire has long been an aspect of human experience, attitudes toward it have been in the past much more ambivalent than they tend to be today. In fact, it's only relatively recently that the human race has convinced itself that passionate curiosity in almost every area of life is a good thing. My talk today has two parts. In the first, we shall look at some of the ways in which pre-modern persons thought about the phenomenon of curiosity. To show you, as Andrew and Pablo have started, that curiosity has a more complicated history than today's attitude toward it might lead you to think. In the second part, we shall examine a particular moment during the early modern period, broadly speaking the 16th and 17th centuries, when a prominent Englishman named Francis Bacon developed a new approach to knowing about the world and valiantly defended it as an acceptable manifestation of curiosity. In doing so, we shall see how features of the science that we know and love today emerged from ways of knowing that were once scorned by intellectual elites and dismissed as a flawed expression of curiosity. Both parts of my talk are relevant to the story that Roger and Andrew tell in The Penultimate Curiosity. As their slipstream analogy suggests, and as Andrew described it again this morning, their focus is primarily on how certain configurations of ultimate curiosity, that is, theological convictions about God and God's relationship to the world, seem to encourage penultimate curiosity about the created order. As Andrew has described it to me, theirs is a history of God-driven science. One of my goals today is to make this story of God-driven science a little bit more complicated, by indicating that even if the right kind of ultimate curiosity is present, this does not mean that penultimate scientific curiosity necessarily follows. That is, even if particular views about divine transcendence and the lawfulness or regularity of the created order are in place, the pursuit of knowledge about less ultimate things, such as the scientific study of nature, independently needs to be viewed positively, or at least successfully defended against charges of misplaced curiosity, before one can really talk about God-driven science. In other words, if curiosity about nature is looked down upon, the details of the prevailing theology about God and God's relationship to the created order doesn't really matter. If this is true, then for the historical moments featured in the penultimate curiosity, God-drivenness may constitute a necessary but not sufficient condition for the pursuit of science. So, to part one. It's often thought that the so-called Dark Ages had a gloomy attitude toward everything. In the case of curiosity, medieval figures generally thought that there were three different types: good, sinful, and in-between, or neutral. When a medieval author uses the term curiosity in their writings, we can't simply assume that the term designates something immoral or sinful, as some modern scholars have thought. In different contexts, the term can have positive, negative, or neutral connotations, depending on how someone thinks about the topic. While this is obviously the same range of possible reactions to curiosity that we might have today, a critical difference between the medieval period and now is the frequency with which medieval authors attach a negative valence to certain manifestations of curiosity. Medievals generally saw the desire to know, a desire they termed curiositas, as a quality neutral and basic to human beings. Aristotle's opening line of his Metaphysics, "All men by nature desire to know," evokes this neutral sense of curiosity. But even before Aristotle's rediscovery in the 12th and 13th centuries, medieval authors saw the desire to know as morally neither praiseworthy nor blameworthy. Here is the 7th century abbot of Malmesbury Abbot in Wiltshire evincing just such an attitude. "I looked over the text of your letters and examined them with quick glimpses of my eyes and contemplated them with a certain natural curiosity for hidden things, and this, it seems, is innate in me, and admired the exuberant style and the maiden urbanity of your eloquence." I'm sure I'm demonstrating urbanity of eloquence today. There is no sense here that just because the abbot is curious, he is therefore immoral. The literary context instead suggests that by the term he intends merely a polite expression of his pleasure in receiving letters and his interest in reading them. From at least as early as the 2nd century, Christian authors happily identified desirable forms of curiosity. We've heard already from Pablo how Tertullian was suspicious of certain forms of curiosity, but more positively, he thought that a positive version of one was the awakening of interest among non-Christians in knowing more about Christianity, the eventual hope for them being their conversion to the faith. A 12th century French Jew who converted to Christianity in 1128 or 1129 described himself as coming to visit the youth of the church with, quote, "friendly curiosity," an attribute for which he was warmly congratulated by the young people of the Christian community. Similarly, admirable curiosity is the diligent care exercised by Christians in the better understanding of their faith. Speaking of the monk Dionysius, the 6th century writer Cassiodorus commended the monk because he had examined and understood the sacred scriptures with such curiositas that when he was questioned about them, he always had a fitting answer and responded without delay. The troublesome thing about curiosity, though, is the relative ease with which positive or neutral forms of it can slide into negative, sinful forms. Medieval historian Richard Neuhauser describes Augustine's 5th century view of the sinful form of curiosity as follows. "Curiositas is that disturbance of the human will which led to an intemperate desire for the knowledge of perishing, worldly, temporal things for the mere sake of acquiring such knowledge alone, which treated the divine mysteries as if they fit into these categories, and which furthermore replaced even the desire for God." Now, while not necessarily representative of everyone who will follow him, Augustine's view is instructive in at least three ways. First, the notion of intemperance points to an appropriate degree of curiosity or desire for knowledge, one that is temperate, moderate, or measured. Neuhauser suggests that the idea of excess, of lack of moderation, of going intemperately beyond a just measure is absolutely central to medieval condemnations of sinful curiosity. Second, the centrality of the will, of human choice based on the direction in which one's desires point one, is also notable. Sinful curiosity is a disturbance of the will, signifying that one's desires are malformed or misdirected. And third, driving the whole concern about intemperance caused by a disordered will is Augustine's worry that the proper object of human desire, God, might be usurped by mere perishing worldly temporal things. In such cases, we desire something creaturely, something created, with an intensity appropriately directed only toward the Creator. Recalling the earlier laudable example of those non-Christians who express an appropriate level of interest in Christianity, a sinful attitude might occur if a Christian is interested in knowing too much about another religion or about a non-Orthodox version of Christianity or heresy. The 12th century French Jew whom I described earlier, the one who was praised for his friendly curiosity toward the faith, was reportedly castigated by his own rabbi for his, quote, illicit curiosity. Sinful curiosity could also manifest itself as an immoderate desire to learn anything, even to learn the truth. The sin here could be either misplaced care lavished on things of this world or an inappropriate attitude toward knowledge and the ends for which it was acquired. Whatever the case may be, sinful curiosity was, in medieval times, likened to a poison which stole away the mind and then plunged the soul into death. A key distinction many medievals made when discussing sinful forms of curiosity is that between the attitude of the desiring person and the object of their desire. Thomas Aquinas, for instance, thought that excessive curiosity might lead one to neglect a duty because one is inordinately interested in something else. For example, this is Aquinas' example, one might fail to turn up for court or to hear a sinner's confession because one is inordinately absorbed by a mathematics problem. Or excessive curiosity might lead one to become so interested in Cicero's eloquence, that one scorns the Bible's straightforwardness in comparison. The objects of curiosity here, mathematics and the Bible, are not the main problems. It's only their participation in a process involving an excess of the will that implicates them. In other cases, the object itself is sinful, such as when many scholars saw heresy, magic, demonology, and alchemy as being, by their very nature, more lethal than other topics or subjects. One needed to proceed with much greater caution when investigating such areas compared to other less explosive ones. We'll return to the topic of magic in part two. I've spent a good deal of time in the medieval period so far, but in this 500th anniversary year of the Reformation, I'd be remiss if I failed to mention at least one important reformer. John Calvin thought that the desire for knowledge is natural to human beings, as did Aristotle, following Aristotle, but it could easily spill over into an excessive form if it were not controlled properly. Regarding the curiosity displayed in the Garden of Eden, Calvin said that Eve erred in not regulating the measure of her knowledge by the will of God. As Eve's descendants, Calvin thought, we rehearse her original fault. We all daily suffer under the same disease because we desire to know more than is right and more than God allows. The echoes of Augustine here are clear. For Calvin and other reformers, the corruption of the desire to know because of the fall led to a vain curiosity that torments the mind with superfluous and useless discussions. Given all that I've shared with you so far, it should come as no surprise to hear that early modern authors, those 16th, 17th century figures, tended to view curiosity very similarly. It's hard to escape the weight of history. Here is Thomas Wright in 1604. a general defect and imperfection proceeding from nature corrupted and tending to corruption followeth all the sons of Adam, and that is a certain natural curiosity. According to Henry Smith in 1592, members of his congregation should not be curious in searching mysteries. One may desire knowledge of God as Solomon did, but not desire knowledge as Eve did. In this period, curiosity was similarly associated with a range of vices like pride, vanity, and ambition. Here is John Downham in 1611. We must labor to mortify our spiritual pride, which is the mother and nurse of this idle curiosity. Curiosity puffeth them up with pride and maketh them in the overweening of their own overweening conceit of their own excellencies to contemn all others. And finally, Thomas Jackson in 1625. Curious speculation of creatures serves to divert many minds from the invisible creator, unto whom the sight of these by nature not mislevelled by inordinate or unyieldy appetites would direct all. Echoes of Augustine here again 1,000 years later. I hope that all of these examples have convinced you that in the medieval, Reformation, and early modern eras, the acquisition of knowledge could at any moment stray from moral neutrality. Different expressions of curiosity were seen as good, bad, or indifferent, depending on the characteristics they exhibited. In practice, the accusation of excessive curiosity was like mud that could be slung in any direction by anyone toward any knowledge acquisition efforts with which they disagreed. Part two. So what has all of this got to do with science? I begin part two by noting that even the most widely accepted way of knowing about nature in the medieval to early modern periods was not itself immune from charges of excessive curiosity. Aristotelian natural philosophy of the scholastic variety had been prominent for several centuries when Thomas Goodwin observed that curiosity is a longing and itching to be fed with and to know things that do not at all concern us. This sounds consistent with what we've heard about the concerns about curiosity, except that in Goodwin's view, among the chief culprits of this prideful self-glorification are those, quote, schoolmen, the scholastics, who speculate wildly and in doing so construct curious webs out of their own bowels. Robert Flood similarly thought that Aristotelianism was false and erroneous, vain, and founded upon the wisdom of the world. True philosophy, in Flood's view, lies buried in darkness through the misty and ambiguous clouds of that cavilling, brabbling, heathenish philosophy which they so adore and follow with their master Aristotle as if he were another Jesus, rained down from heaven to open unto mankind the treasures of true wisdom. Now, for a well-established approach like Aristotelian natural philosophy, isolated criticisms like those of Goodwin and Flood would have had little impact. But the 16th and 17th centuries saw scholastic natural philosophy criticized on many fronts, and alternative approaches to studying the natural order grew more prominent. Given how easily accusations of improper curiosity could be thrown around, what any new approach to studying nature needed was a capable and vocal defender, one who could persuasively position the new approach as an appropriate form of curiosity. 17th century England had just such a man, Francis Bacon. Bacon is a crucial figure in the history of science because he developed a new approach to knowing nature, one the emergence of which is widely recognized as a crucial step along the path to our modern science. He also matters to our topic of curiosity today for at least two reasons. First, Bacon's new approach to nature contained old elements, ones that had previously been criticized as misguided manifestations of curiosity. So not only did Bacon have to present his new approach in general as immune to the typical criticisms leveled against new ways of knowing nature, he also had to convince others that those older and previously criticized elements that he co-opted in his new approach were worth redeeming. Second, if the historians are to be believed, in doing this, Bacon helped put the positive spin on curiosity that is typical of our own day. Historian Peter Harrison has argued that in Bacon's time, new projects to expand knowledge about nature generally needed to do three things. First, they needed to position themselves as morally upright pursuits. Second, they needed to counter common biblical objections to the promotion of learning by rereading the narrative of the temptation in the garden. And third, they needed to produce knowledge that is useful. Regarding moral uprightness, Bacon put forward a variety of arguments for his new scheme. For instance, he asserted that knowledge of the world is neither forbidden nor exceeds our capacities, because God has fitted the world to human capacities. In his Valerius Terminus in 1603, he claimed that whatsoever is not God but parcel of the world, he, God, hath fitted it for the comprehension of man's mind, if man will only open and dilate the powers of understanding as he may. And in the Advancement of Learning of 1605, he wrote, God hath framed the mind of man as a mirror or glass, capable of the image of the universal world. In Bacon's view, human capabilities match perfectly the capabilities needed to know nature. So knowledge of nature is neither beyond our reach nor inherently problematic. Regarding the Garden of Eden, in Bacon's time it was regularly assumed that the fall resulted from giving in to the temptation to know more than one should. Bacon concedes that the pursuit of knowledge can in some instances corrupt the knower, but only when knowledge is pursued for the wrong reasons. The human race fell not because Adam sought knowledge, but because he did so out of pride, thought Bacon. For Bacon, knowledge that is obtained pridefully, quote, hath in it some venom and something of the serpent. On this view, prideful knowledge projects are inherently problematic, but pursuing knowledge about nature isn't necessarily sinful. Only if we are prideful shall we follow Adam's lead. Bacon thus neutralizes those critics who see Adam's progeny, us, necessarily sinning, no matter how that knowledge is obtained. So if feeding one's pride is the wrong reason to pursue knowledge, what, in Bacon's view, is the right reason to pursue it? Here he is again in Valerius Terminus. Knowledge of nature must be subject to that use for which God hath granted it, which is the benefit and relief of the state and society of man. For otherwise all manner of knowledge becometh malign and serpentine, and therefore, as carrying the quality of the serpent's sting and malice, it maketh the mind of man to swell. As the scripture saith excellently, knowledge bloweth up, but charity buildeth up. Knowledge that is beneficial to others avoids the sin of pride, being instead an instance of the theological virtue of charity. Along similar lines in his Great Instauration of 1620, Bacon asks his readers to consider what are the true ends of knowledge, and encourages them to seek it, not either for pleasure of the mind, or for contention, or for superiority to others, or for profit, or fame, or power, or any of these inferior things, but for the benefit and use of life, and that they perfect and govern it in charity. So if charity is one's motivation, Bacon thinks, one cannot really put a foot wrong. In these three ways, Bacon overcomes some of the common complaints against new efforts to obtain knowledge that arose from the discourse of curiosity in his day. But as I said earlier, Bacon's new approach to knowing nature also contained features derived from a tradition that had long been criticized by the intellectual elite. That tradition from which Bacon drew is the natural magic tradition. According to the magical view, all bodies have occult qualities which make them capable of acting upon other bodies in various ways. These occult or hidden interactions were usually described in terms of sympathies or antipathies between bodies. So John Henry, a historian of this, says, the main method of putting magical knowledge to use is to bring together a body known to have a specific action and the body upon which it is known to act, or else to separate such reactants for a negative effect. To know magic is to know which pairs of bodies go sympathetically together to predictably bring about effects in nature. The best magicians knew which bodies generated particularly marvelous effects. Because it was concerned with events that occurred unexpectedly through insensible causes, natural magic differed dramatically from the prevailing Aristotelian natural philosophy of Bacon's day. For followers of Aristotle, scientia, science, meant demonstrable knowledge of the universal and necessary causes of normal quotidian natural phenomena. That is, natural philosophy sought to describe and classify ordinary, regular physical events, common events as well, I should say. Because of this focus on regularities and commonalities in nature, rarities and marvels were thought to lie outside the domain of science. From the scholastic Aristotelian vantage point, the rare occurrences that magicians knew and loved were not demonstrable in this Aristotelian way, and so they were not thought to be plausible objects of scientific knowledge. Now, medievals didn't merely separate magical and scientific knowledge. The elites in the centuries before Bacon disdained magic as a paradigmatic example of forbidden knowledge. Rather than constituting a legitimate intellectual inquiry, magic was viewed as a form of aimless erudition, of curiositas. Many medievals believed that God had intended nature to be a mystery, and had so fashioned the world as to make many of its secrets occult and unintelligible. Those who sought knowledge of these things were therefore highly suspicious. As one historian has put it, to pry into mysteries, I've already got it up here, to pry into mysteries of nature that God chose not to reveal, as the brazen magi attempted to do, was to trespass the boundary of legitimate intellectual inquiry, to challenge God's majesty, and to enter into the territory of forbidden knowledge. Magic was repudiated for other reasons too. Because one couldn't clearly identify the causes of an occult phenomenon, religious authorities worried that demons or the devil might be involved. The boundary between natural and demonic magic was ambiguous at this time, and so magic might tempt practitioners into making pacts with demons to learn the secrets of creation. Magic also frequently involved one of curiosity's greatest dangers, pride. Magicians not only pried into nature's hidden recesses and stole its secrets, they used this illicitly won knowledge to glorify themselves and to impress the world with their marvels. And third, magic was regarded as a perversion of that Aristotelian legitimate science in the sense that it tempts nature and causes it to do what it would not, under ordinary circumstances, do on its own if left to its own devices. Criticisms of these were common in Bacon's time. In James I's Demonology of 1597, we read, "Certain learned men, mounting free degree to degree upon the slippery slope and uncertain scale of curiosity, are at last enticed, where lawful arts or sciences fail, to satisfy their restless minds, even to seek to that black and unlawful science of magic." In doing so, he thought, they follow Adam in his desire for forbidden knowledge. Their knowledge, for all that they presume thereof, is nothing increased except in knowing evil, as Adam's was by eating of the forbidden tree. Theologian William Perkins similarly saw the cursed art of magic and witchcraft as a way to get further knowledge in matters secret and not revealed. None of this seems to have fazed Bacon, who saw two things of great value in the natural magic tradition. The first was magic's focus on empirical knowledge. As the causes of many things in nature are occult or hidden, one cannot easily deduce their effects in advance. Rather, one comes to know which bodies go together to produce which effects only through long experience of trial and error. And second, this empiricism meant attending both to the regular phenomena that had been of interest to Aristotle's natural philosophy and to those unusual phenomena that were regarded as outside the bounds of Aristotelian science. Put another way, natural magic was interested in everything. As prominent magician Giambattista della Porta wrote, magic is nothing else but the survey of the whole course of nature. And as Cornelius Agrippa said, magicians are careful explorers of nature. Given magic's perceived association with pride and with following in the footsteps of Adam, we can now appreciate why Bacon's defense of his new natural philosophy required him to deal with both of these criticisms head on. By co-opting the magical tradition's long commitment to the utility of knowledge for his new natural philosophy, Bacon transformed early modern natural philosophy. What had once been a mostly speculative and contemplative discipline became an experimental and utilitarian one, one whose charitable goals rendered it immune to accusations that it constituted an excessive form of curiosity. Despite happily drawing from the natural magic tradition, Bacon remained critical of the magical tradition as a whole, and one finds many complaints about magic in his writings. But the inadequacies of natural magic that Bacon identifies usually have more to do with those frauds and charlatans who sought to deceive a gullible public through displays of amazing and unexpected effects. It's for this reason that Bacon's apparent inconsistencies, criticizing magic with one hand while taking from it with the other, these should be understood instead as the identification of wheat amongst chaff. Here is science writer Philip Ball's neat summary of Bacon's project, which emphasizes this aspect. By welding magic's experimental attitude to the reason of natural philosophy, he, Bacon, hoped to delineate a true and useful approach to the study of nature. While he accused astrology, natural magic, and alchemy of swaying the imagination more than reason, he felt that they needed to be reformed rather than abandoned. To conclude, is Francis Bacon ultimately responsible for the overly curious Chinese tourists who gawk at their North Korean neighbors? Probably not. But Bacon has doubtless contributed to the generally positive attitude that we moderns typically have toward curiosity. More importantly, our modern penultimate curiosity is indebted to Bacon's rehabilitation of things once viewed as manifestations of excessive curiosity. Other such curious episodes in the intertwined histories of science and of curiosity surely lie in wait for those curious enough to go looking. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. We've kept wonderfully to time, and we have a few moments for questions. Who would like to? I saw hands shoot up at the back. Thank you.
Thanks. It's Andrew Steen. Thanks for allowing me to ask a question. This is perhaps to the whole audience. My understanding is one of the things that we heard in the various quotes there was the connection of the word knowledge with the account of the Garden of Eden. But of course, a careful reading of that text insists that what is the title given to that tree is not simply the word knowledge. You know, it's a bigger phrase. You know, it's often translated knowledge of good and evil. And I'm not going to claim to know that that's very obviously interpreted one way or another, but I want to make sure we all agree that, in fact, what's described there in that narrative is not merely or simply, in any sense, a tree whose title means knowledge. It's not quite as simple as that. And I think maybe some of the quotes that people have found themselves using over the years have just sort of forgotten that and not really thought about it. And I'm interested to get your sense of that.
So, even though I have a theology degree, I don't feel especially comfortable doing the normative move of claiming to know what the scriptures definitively should mean. I guess I'm much more interested personally in the descriptive account of what other people have thought of it. So I think it's interesting that you've pointed this out. I think you're probably right. I think that people have used the Garden of Eden story for different purposes at different times to accomplish certain purposes. And that's really what, as a historian, I love to understand. Why was the Garden of Eden story deployed in this particular way? So if you've got a different kind of defense of, or different understanding of knowledge involved, or a different understanding of the word, that you're using it for a different purpose, perhaps, from the people who've used it in different ways. It might be perfectly legitimate, but then somebody else might come along and disagree with you as well. I guess I'm trying to express a reluctance to claim that you've necessarily got the definitive account and that these people don't, but there all attempts to provide a definitive account really are part of the ebb and flow of debate and trying to achieve certain other purposes. And so that's, I don't know, I apologize if that's not an adequate response for you. It's just the historian in me not the theologian.
Another question. Maybe I can ask, is that I heard the words utility and usefulness on several occasions in reference to Bacon. Do you want to talk about and take that forward to blue sky research and those of us who might be engaged in that, where it doesn't have no obvious utility?
So take it forward in the sense that, in that case, then Bacon isn't necessarily the only influence or source for modern science, that science retains a desire to be curious about things that don't have an obvious utility. Again, I think Bacon was trying to defend his use of magic because of its utility, because that served his purposes at the time to forward his particular knowledge project. But that, I guess, in a way, it's not necessarily the whole story of modern science, definitely. And I'm sure Bacon himself retained a curiosity about non-useful things, non-useful knowledge too.
I'm relieved to hear that. There's a hand there in the first
talk, Andrew put up Maxwell's equations. And I was taught those many, many years ago when I did physics at Cambridge. And I was told that they're all you ever need to know about electromagnetism. And I believe that until maybe 5 years ago. When you look into it, there weren't four equations when Maxwell made them. There were about 24. And they were written in quaterniums, and that generates all sorts of non-linearities and scalar fields, which actually you could interpret as magic. So some of the things that exist... scientists don't understand because we haven't been taught the right theories, and it's all very much an approximation. So I think we're on a gradual process of actually, you know, evolving science and learning science. And as we do that, some of the things that would be regarded as magic fall out of those, you know, properly used equations.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point. I guess my response is how the word magic, what's presumed to be under its purview, has changed over time. As you're absolutely right, the configurations of different disciplines have changed with respect to each other. And so really what Bacon is doing is taking something from what's regarded as a problematic discipline and claiming it for himself. So seeing the utility of it allows him to make that move while repudiating magic as a whole. But that's not to say that magic for other people didn't retain useful elements for other kinds of projects that they were engaged in, or that it wouldn't have happened 200 years later, that perhaps what had been seen as magic might be replaced by some other form of knowledge. I mean, these configurations of knowledge, the boundaries are just changing constantly, and the way in which terms like magic are seen is changing constantly, whether it's a bad thing or a good thing. So history is just such a rich and complicated world of these reconfigurations going on over time for all sorts of different reasons.
I'll take one last question, just coming forward a few there.
You've said a great deal about magic, and you've indicated that it's seen in different ways by different people. Could you give us a definition of what was understood by magic in those days?
Yeah, it's that the sense that there are occult or hidden causes of things that we can't manifestly see. So the magnet is a perfect example of an occult object, because its causes are things that we can't necessarily deduce just from looking at a magnet. So it's this sense that you've got to explore how the magnet interacts with other bodies, these sympathies and antipathies between bodies. That was sort of regarded as the purview of magic. The Aristotelians weren't interested in going to that kind of experimental detail. They were mostly a bookish kind of understanding of nature, long studies of texts that have once been based on observations of nature, but your average scholastic in the medieval period wouldn't necessarily look at nature at all. I mean, you've got exceptions for people like Roger Bacon, who was heavily experimental, but that's because, in fact, he was influenced by the magical tradition, historians would argue. So it's that sense of the unusual and occult, these hidden phenomena that you're trying to understand and simply just put to use by demonstrating its wonder. Magicians often had places in royal courts because of the effects that they could generate using two objects that you and I wouldn't necessarily have any idea interacted, but because of their sympathies in particular ways, generated the most marvelous phenomena that kings and queens would have loved. So it's that, I think that's really what the nub of magic is here.
Lovely, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
So we move on to our next speaker, who Jennifer Wiseman, who will be the